we go. Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And, boy, that song is just amazing. I was watching the whole room, and I didn't see anybody that wasn't reacting to it. There's something about that. I don't know, I think magic, they have shows on TV to show how the trick is done. And I just go, what the hell would you want to do that for? You're missing the whole point. It's to just be fooled by it and to just go, oh my God, look at that. It's a mystery, and I don't know what it is, but there's two types of people when they're confronted with a mystery. One wants to figure it out, and one wants to enjoy it. And God's a mystery. Which category are you in? You trying to figure him out or just enjoy him? And we get hung up on that, figuring stuff out. You know, I can figure it out. It's, anyway, there was a couple of things before I got into the 6 and 7 that these are just principles that have to be incorporated into our lives. And one of them is forgiveness. This may be one of the least discussed issues in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's one of the most powerful things that we have at our disposal to make life a comfortable journey. And my own experience involving the death of my daughter, somehow I was led to use forgiveness as the way of handling everything. And so I look back on it and I realize that I, due to other circumstances, had decided to become a forgiving person. That's step one, to go from where you are now to becoming a forgiving person, is to make a decision that from this day forward, I'm going to be a forgiving person. I'm going to move myself up about 6 notches in the spiritual ladder. And I am going, and you can pray about it, you can do, but the big thing is the decision to become a forgiving person. So the first thing that happens when something happens to us is we forgive it. We just forgive it. And we go to God and we say, generally, well, let me just expand it one little bit. Generally, when we get news that is of this magnitude, it doesn't have to be that big, but we don't take it in all at once. We go look for a place to sit down. Now we're going to experience it. And so while we're doing that, we can say to God, I just want you to know that this is not going to change how I feel about you. You are still the most important power in my life. I love you, and I just want you to know that before I start to allow this to come in. And as you allow this to come in, guess who comes right in with it to help you is God. And there really is nothing that cannot be forgiven. So we don't need, I remember talking to my sponsor, somebody had taken $10 and he was gone from the military base. And I said, what am I going to do about that? I need the $10. He says, why don't you just forgive him? He's another guy like you. He's broke. He's, you know, I said, okay. And then he said, a couple of months later, there's another guy with $30, which in the 60s was a lot of money, so I'm going to him, and he said, why don't you just forgive him? And I said, well, where the hell, how far is this going? I mean, what, am I going to forgive 1,000? I'm going to forgive 50,000? And I said, where is the limit? And he said, well, let me think here. I remember some long period ago, there was a man they were hammering to a cross after they had whipped him and tortured him to death. And he said, forgive them. They know not what they do. So if you ever have something happen to you that is worse than being nailed to a cross and being whipped to death, bring it up and we'll discuss it. So I was going, holy cow. I'm sure if you spend some time just deciding that you are going to move yourself into that category, you're going to get so many benefits that you will be absolutely amazed. And the other thing is death. As soon as you say the word, the room gets real quiet, you know, death. Is there another lecture somewhere? I don't want to hear a lecture on death. And look what St. Francis says, is by dying that we awaken to life eternal. And so the only part of you that's worried about death is your ego, because he's the only thing that disappears. And if we're working a good program, we're trying to kill him anyway. So there's no... So somehow, if you can get comfortable with that idea, because the ego loves to use death as a way of screwing up your day. One last thing is, I've decided that my ego wants to get back together with God just as much as I do. He was just given a rotten role to play as a spoiler. And you know what I'm talking about? It's like poor Judas. He was singled out to be the one that has to be the betrayer. You know what I mean? And so I've made friends with my ego, and I've decided that he has no choice. That's his job. Is to look at things wrong, mislead me, scare me, frighten me, get me upset, and all these things. But in the final analysis, he's sick of the job. I mean, you can imagine, your ego's been at it ever since you were born. So I've let him off the hook too, so... Well, that has nothing to do with step 6 and 7, but I had a funny run of things. I don't know if any of you have run in, but I've had 6 guys in a row moving from step 5 to step 6 with the most unusual thing. Of course, I do what everybody else does when you're starting step 6. I say, let me see your bucket. And 6 in a row were trying to make mortar without sand. And it was so hard to send them back. See, no one knows the big book. What's the last line in step 5? Are you trying to make mortar without sand? Okay. I'm going to mark that down. Don't use that again. It's not funny. So when you look at step 6 and 7, this is quite a package in the middle of our steps. And make sure you, I shouldn't be doing this to new people, make sure you understand the difference between defects of character and shortcomings before you even... before you even move ahead, because if you don't understand that, the whole damn thing won't work. Build just used the synonym. There is no meaning in the fact that one says defects and one says shortcomings, so we'll get that out of the way. So here, just about right in the middle of the program, when you look in the big book, you see the two paragraphs and we're through. And there it is. We've now completed step 7. And when you move over to the 12 and 12, the sixth step starts out with, this is the step that separates the men from the boys, the girls from the women. So it's announcing this is incredibly important. And on the other hand, it appears that it just requires a couple of paragraphs. I think this is a place where Bill looked at the discussion. And while the prayer and the discussion is completely valid and right on target, it doesn't call our attention to it enough to see how powerful this is in our spiritual growth. And so the one thing out of the big book that I enjoy is that the prayer says, take all of me, the good and the bad. And I think it says that because the good was determined by me. You know what I mean? Well, this is good, and I'm in that area, I'm doing pretty good. And who knows if it's good? So just take everything. And we'll all get to start from the same spot. One of the things that Bill and Dr. Bob had great discussions on were the four absolutes from the Oxford movement. And there was quite a difference between New York and Akron. And the Cleveland Intergroup still prints a pamphlet on the four absolutes. And on the back it says, this is official AA literature. And there was, you know, there's nothing New York can do about it. And there's, part of me enjoys this very much. That they're not able to do anything about it. But there was a difference of viewpoints on how rapidly to move people towards God. And of course in Akron it was get on your knees. I mean, you know, you just, we're going upstairs, are you going to surrender? And people from other parts of the country would say, boy, if AA was like that in my place, I never would have got sober. How do you know? How do you know? You might have better sobriety than you do now. We don't know that. And the same thing if we talked about the way New York was doing it, which was, let's postpone discussing God for a while, and we'll talk in more psychological terms, we'll talk about the fatal nature of the illness, and then we'll sort of mention that there is this other part of the program. And maybe we'll get more people to stay. So you could see that there was good thinking on both parts, but they were at odds with each other. And so Bill thought about the four absolutes and decided, this his own decision, that it was too much for the alcoholic to encompass, to be grabbing on to absolute conditions. Later on, he wrote a letter where he said that he probably had made a mistake. And so he snuck him in to the sixth step in the 12 and 12. And suddenly you will find that as we move from the big book to the 12 and 12, we move from progress, not perfection, to progress towards perfection. Uh-oh. Now we are raising our view to a much higher level. But he goes on from there to point out what he calls the riddle of our existence. And the riddle is that the biggest defect that we have, our drinking, was in fact entirely removed by us becoming entirely ready to have it removed. And so the question is, why do you still have lust? Why don't you just apply the same willingness and get rid of that, and get rid of greed, and get rid of this and that? And he goes on to say, well, the answer is probably in the mind of God, and we may not ever get it, but I'm going to guess. So he guesses, and what his guess is that the drinking problem is fatal. The other ones are too, but we can't see it. And that drinking is going to kill us. And even the ego doesn't want to die over something. And so it becomes entirely ready. It's willing to totally surrender the drink problem to this higher power. And we are in a state of 100% willingness for this to be removed. And in many cases, it is. I haven't thought about drinking since probably the third month of my sobriety. It's never entered my mind to take a drink. Suicide, murder, all those other things, they enter. But it's just never, you know, listen, why don't I have a drink? It just doesn't come up. And I know there's many people who have had that freedom, but not all of us. Dr. Bob struggled with it for a couple of years. He was just struggling with the desire to have a drink, which is, and who knows why we're different like that. So Bill goes on to say, then what about the rest of our defects and step six? And his whole discussion there is just so on target. You can just see how we handle perfection. First, we go back to the big book and say, I like the big book better. It says progress, not perfection. So I'm going to stay there. But we know it's sitting there. We know this idea is still there. And he goes on to start discussing how we handle the idea of perfection. We look at it, each defect, whatever it is, greed, I don't want a lot of money, just a little bit, just enough to get me by. People tell us that money's not going to make us happy, that we should be very comfortable with the idea of living on whatever comes our way. We should be comfortable with that. They even point out that money itself tells us that, because the money has a warning label on it. It says, don't trust me. In God we trust. So we're being signaled everywhere that this is not going to make us happy. And we agree with it, but we think we should have a little bit anyway. We think we should have a little bit anyway. And so what the bottom line is, we tend to settle for as much perfection as will get us by. That's where we put it. We don't want to be lustful enough to rape or angry enough to murder. So we settle like the businessman who wants people to do business with him. What he wants is not to be locked into total honesty, but to have an honest reputation so that people will buy stuff from him. So he is happy to settle for being known as an honest man. Not being an honest man, but being known as an honest man. You see what I'm saying? Because he doesn't want a deal to fall through because he isn't allowed the businessman's right to finagle things. And so he settles for that. And as we go down each one of the character defects, we find that if we were asked to dial in what you're willing to give up, lust. Who wants to give up 100% of lust? No hands so far. Could I see 75%? Would you be willing to go 75? Whoa. Why? Well, lust is enjoyable. I mean, you don't want to be caught doing something that might embarrass you. But on the other hand, you'd like to reserve the right to think about things that if your neighbor knew you were thinking, might go, whoa, I didn't know that. Imagine if our thoughts were on a loudspeaker. So, and the one, I didn't think of myself as a gossip. You know what I mean? But boy, when two people were spreading some word, I would get these people to quiet down so that I could hear, what was that? And I thought of myself, I never was the initiator of gossip. I was like a telephone line where the gossip starts here and it goes over there. So I was merely a relay station, which has very little to do with the character defect of gossiping, per se. And so the list can go on and on. The lengths that we will go to not address 100% attack on anything. So that sentence in the middle of that step where it says we tend to settle for as much perfection as will get us by is an awful powerful sentence. It's, and I'm sure if you look at your own lives, it's like you want to keep something. This is our world. And like I was saying yesterday, I gave up Rhode Island. I'd like to keep something that is mine. And I remember there's an old poem, Dante's Inferno. It must be 500 years old or whatever. And it's all about heaven and hell. And it's almost like the punchline is, to rule in hell or to serve in heaven? What's your choice? If you go to hell, you're in charge. You're in charge of everything. You can create any illusion you want. You can have big mansion. You can have this. You're going to be alone, but you can have anything you want. But if you go to heaven, you're going to have to be a servant of God. It's hard to be 100% servant the way we're structured. We're structured with these instinctual drives. And the only hope we have is of reducing them. And as Bill says, in most cases, we're going to have to settle for patient improvement. But at the end of the step, he talks about the possibility that we may be able to achieve victory 100% over some of them. And I don't know why, but that caught my eye when I was looking at the step. I think in the last 5 years or so, there's something about me that doesn't want to concede that you can't move beyond wherever you are on this. And that a higher level of seeking towards perfection is not a waste of time. That it's a struggle that is well worth taking. I think Bill was looking for a way when he was writing this and in later letters to offer more hope in that step, to offer a chance that at least on two or three that we were able to eliminate them from our lives. I haven't been able to do it, and so I'm reporting that. But something tells me that maybe 10 years from now, I'll be able to say, I got rid of this one, which would be exciting to say that. It would be a really great moment. So in case I didn't mention, the step said we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, which we discussed in our fourth and fifth step. And if you knew, why do we want to do that? Well, number one, they're getting us in a lot of trouble. Number two, they're keeping us separated from the greatest source of help that we can have, which is God. And so it's almost the place where we dial in how much spirituality we want and how hard we're willing to try to go after it. And so once we were given this news in the sixth step, we didn't ask for anything to be removed. We just tried to get ready to have it removed by God. And the next thing we find out in the seventh step is, and I hate to lead with this, by the way, this process is going to be incredibly painful. Hope that doesn't slow you down at all when you find that out. Because ego crushing is a painful process. But it's painful because we're just starting out at it. It's like a person who's gotten out of shape and they decide to get back in shape. You remember what the muscles felt like when you went back in the gym and tried to do what you used to do before you took 3 years off to drink milkshakes? And you come home and you're in agony. Remember, I just couldn't believe how much it could hurt. It's just like you didn't even want to go back the next day. It was awful. But as time went on, the painful exercise in the beginning became just effort. It wasn't painful. It was effort. And then as the effort produced results, we began to enjoy the effort because of the results we were getting. And so our whole attitude towards the process changed because of the results we were getting. And so step 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, obviously is totally consumed with humility. It is, and as of course Bill writes right off the bat, humility has had a hard time of it in our world. You call somebody, you know, like let's say four guys are getting together and a new guy comes along or they haven't met yet. And while introducing him, you say, this man is one of the most humble people I know. He's probably going to tell you later, don't call me that. That's not a compliment. Humble? What the hell? That's like you get pushed around, man. You don't push me around. So you don't see anybody advertising a Buick telling you that you'll be humble when you get it. And you ought to pay extra for it because it includes humility in the sales price. It's not there because everything in the material world is geared to pride. That's what we got to go after. If you're driving this Buick, people are going to look up to you and go, look at that guy driving a Buick over there. He must be somebody. I mean, do you think you could sell a Buick saying, people will look and go, look, there's a hole in the donut driving that Buick. So, one of the first things we learn about humility is it is the greatest gift that God gives us. It is an offer for Him to do all the work and you to get all the results. Just stop trying to be in charge of anything. We just need you to give up any idea of running your life. And then you'll be given all the help you need. You won't do anything. Just let go of control of your life. God will be glad to do the work. And as we talked yesterday, letting go is one of the hardest exercises that we have. Humility has many definitions. It is a total absence of pride and is an immediate change of perspective on our whole lives. When we adopt the idea of humility, we will find that we have made a decision to relinquish the most important gift that we've been given, which is free will, and we're going to give it to God, which is also the third step. It's very close to that. Bill writes that humility is contained in all of our 12 steps. Each one of them is designed to make us more close to the concept and power of humility. And every time we want to give something up, it's going to be as painful as it was when we gave up the thing before it. And there's a willingness to go ahead with this because of the results that we get. It is a transforming power that takes us to the real world. This is the way it was intended. It was intended that God supply all of the power to transform us. If we were able to give up something on our own, it would work against us. Let's say that I'm a smoker and I want to get rid of smoking, and people say, well, ask God to help you. No, I can do it. I don't need God's help. And you succeed. You've really accomplished something wonderful. This is a tremendous benefit to your life and is obviously quite an accomplishment. So what do you think pride does with that accomplishment that you just did? It uses it against you. It just says, look, smoking is a really hard thing to do. You did it on your own. Not many people can do that. You can get rid of lust on your own if you can stop smoking on your own. And it brings us back to accomplishing things on our own, which is the essence of all the problems that we have. My resistance to not being in charge of something. You'd think God would give us some little thing, you know, like, okay, the pig pen, you're in charge of the pig pen. Go out and clean it up and all of that. But, you know, he wants the pig pen turned over as well. So here we go. We're in this. That's why these steps are so crucial, because they have a tendency to force us to compromise. That's what they do. They have a tendency to force us to compromise in order to get on with it. You know, how long am I going to be screwing around in here? I need something. And so going back to humility on a constant basis, getting up in the morning, asking for the freedom to surrender, asking for a perspective on the day that enables us to see that the best thing we can possibly do is to just sit and wait for guidance. Sit and pray for guidance. If there's no guidance, then there shouldn't be any action. And people say, well, no, you got, some things have to be done now. Some things have to. And Very often that's not true. At the end of the, I wrote this down because I hadn't noticed it before, but at the end of the seventh step, Bill ends the step with this. It says, if that degree of humility could enable us to find the grace by which such a clearly a deadly obsession, drinking, could be banished, then there must be hope of the same result respecting any other problem we could possibly have. And so, you know, as Bill outlined both of these steps with the sense that we were going to have to settle for as much progress as he could get, he ends up by saying that there must be hope, the same result respecting any other problem we could possibly have. And I look at that, and one, I would love to have a conversation with Bill about that sentence, that why you put that entirely different tone at the very end of the step, where it's suggesting that maybe as AA progresses, maybe as people are working the steps and trying different things, that there will be a means of total elimination of one of these defects. This is the kind of stuff that this mind thinks about. You can see why it puts me in strange places. Because I like the idea that there is the possibility of this. Generally, when I talk about these things, I have a lot of fun with them. And I haven't been able to do that today. I think I was being too serious, which is no fun for me and no fun for you, but what the hell? Can't win them all. I think it's... I think I've been thinking about this, which is a very bad thing. I've been talking about this, which is a very bad thing, and can't find what I would call like the missing link or something that is just seems like it's right around the corner. So if I would summarize this to anybody new, you are presented in these two steps with a tremendous dilemma. This is one of the hardest dilemmas you're going to find in AA. You're going to find an unclear picture that you're trying to go towards. You're going to find that it can't be laid out very clearly, and yet we still have to try. When Bill writes something like, the answer may only be in the mind of God, and that this is the riddle of our existence, he paints a picture that you don't see in many other steps. Most of the other steps are fairly clear on how you move from the beginning to the other end. And we're left with this. I suppose the best thing to do as you're working at it is to laugh at yourself when you fail, but to keep trying. It's except for that last sentence that I read, it's generally left that no matter how hard you try, you're not going to get there. But you've got to keep trying. And so if you have that sense of frustration, so does everybody else. Everybody else realizes that they're going after something that is quite noble. It's quite a thing in society to be trying to make yourself a perfect servant to the people around you. And that it's going to be painful, frustrating, but you're going to keep at it. I like watching people try, fail, try in these areas and get right back up and give it another try. It's just amazing. And I like watching new people who get it quickly. There's no reason they did any more than somebody else takes 5 or 6 years to even get started. And then when things come easily, there's an assumption that everything's going to be easy. And then you get hit in the head with a bat and you go, oh, I guess I'm not as good as I thought I was. So when you come to these steps, don't breeze by them on the grounds that, well, it can't be done. I would just focus as much energy as you can and realize that what you're trying to accomplish is of great assistance to the people around you. It is the one effort that will sow results for years, because others are going to watch you go through situations and see how you handle them. And they're going to see a very minimum of character defects getting in the way. And they're going to wonder about that. That song, Wonderful World, I think that's what did it. That song just got me. It just got me with the beauty of it. Why was that so powerful? Because it changed our perspective on everything. While you're listening to that, you started realizing, in spite of all your ideas, it is a wonderful world. And we're so lucky to be here. And we're so lucky to become aware of our place here. In case you're wondering, I can tell you when the world's going to end. It's going to end when I die. And your world is going to end when you die. Because we're not in the same world, right? You don't live in the same world I do. If I were to describe my world, you'd say, no, that's not my world. My world is like this. There's a bunch of mean people and they're picking on me. That's my world. And you say, well, certainly there's got to be a real world in addition to the individual worlds that we all live on. And you go, well, maybe, but nobody lives there. That's not fair. And that's why that song is just, what does it say to us? It says, you're wrong. It's a wonderful world. That's what it said. And then the lyrics and the music are so powerful, then you realize that you're wrong. You're totally wrong. It's a wonderful world. So I think with that, I'll just close on the, leave it as a wonderful world. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Chris.